sunshine and 42 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. You can build a career as a licensed professional counselor and mental health and wellness advocate with the new Master's in Mental Health and Counseling from Parkside. More information is available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Before we get started with today's morning show, we do want to remind you that Wisconsin Public Radio is in the midst of its spring membership drive, and it is a perfect opportunity for you to tangibly express your appreciation to Wisconsin Public Radio and specifically to WGTD if you appreciate what you hear over the airwaves of WGTD each and every day. There are two ways in which you can contact Wisconsin Public Radio and become a member. You can do so online by going to www.wpr.org, or if you prefer to speak with a friendly volunteer, you can call them toll-free at 888-202-2552, 888-202-2552, and your support of Wisconsin Public Radio very directly supports WGTD. And as a matter of fact, if you want to make specific mention of the fact that you are a WGTD listener, and better yet, if you want to mention that you're a morning show listener, that would be wonderful as well. Once again, the website you should visit is www.wpr.org. Otherwise, you can call 1-888-202-2552. And we do thank you for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio and WGTD. Today, I'm very, very happy to welcome back into our studios for his monthly visit to the program, Dr. Art Sear, who is Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. He is director of the A.W. Clausen Center and author of After the Cold War, and a columnist whose works appear in newspapers across the country and in some other countries as well. And it is indeed a privilege to have him be a regular visitor to the morning show. Professor Sear, we welcome you back.
Well, thanks, Greg. It's always a pleasure and always educational to be with you.
Well, you were present for a really big and exciting event at Carthage College, which unfortunately I had to miss because of a performance I had down in Illinois that necessitated my absence from the inauguration of Dr. John Swallow to be Carthage's 23rd president. But I know that you were there, and I think some of our listeners might be interested to hear a little bit about what the ceremony this past Saturday was like. What happened?
Well, it was very positive. I found it actually quite inspiring. Among other things, you see people that you haven't seen for a long time that are part of our Carthage community, and That's one part of it. It was remarkably inclusive, which is all to the good. There was very good community representation. And people who were close to our new president from his earlier career. We had a very, very strong musical dimension, and the food was good, as it usually is on campus. And the substance was good, too. A song had been composed by a friend of President Swallow's, and he sang the verses and the dinner on Saturday night, and his wife and daughters and the audience joined in for the chorus. And I think a president who sings, that's got to be a good omen and a good sign, and and the music was pretty good.
Wow. Well, glad to hear it. I should hasten to add that I've had the pleasure of singing with Dr. Swallow on a couple of different occasions. Well, there are three of us. Well, there are three of us on the music faculty who join with him. We've done so twice as the male quartet known as the Four Torchmen, and we sang at the big banquet following the Christmas festival, and then we sang at the inaugural ball. And uh-huh. He's a very fine singer, actually. And in addition to that kind of sort of easygoing sort of singing, he and his wife have both sung considerable amount in community choruses and symphonic choruses over the years. And this past fall, when Carthage Choir celebrated a special 90th anniversary, they made a point of coming to greet the many alums who had come to sing in an alumni choir. And then they asked if they could join the rehearsal. And they were there for the next hour and a half singing with everybody else. So very serious singers and very, very skilled singers. So that's always a plus in my book, of course.
Who came up with the title Torchman?
Torchman. That I do not know. Uh-huh. So I suggested all the president's men, but I was voted down. So one of my colleagues came up with the Four Torchmen. But in all seriousness, he's actually a very good singer, and so it's been a pleasure to sing with him, and look forward to future opportunities to do so.
A man of parts, all good. We should underscore that the torch is an important central symbol of Carthage College, and that's all positive as well, since the South was well represented during the. Quite rightly, given where President Swallow has spent his earlier career, it was no implication of General Sherman or anything that might at all be negative.
So it sounds like it was an exciting day at Carthage, and glad that so many people could be to be on hand.
Yeah, it was very well attended and extremely positive. And John's two predecessors, Greg Woodward, who was with us for 5 years, and is now in. Connecticut, I think, at Hartford University, and Greg Campbell, who was with us for 25 years, came from the University of Chicago, and is still active doing some work for the Board of Trustees of the college, but also chair of our local hospital. Mm-hmm. That was very good in terms of showing continuity, and I thought that...
So they were there?
Yeah. Ah. They came in, and they were recognized, and recognized very appropriately, I must say.
Fantastic. That is nice to hear.
Yeah.
Very good.
And
well,
since I didn't have to do anything. I just got to sit and enjoy it. It was
got to be an audience member.
Quite nice.
Yeah, very good. Well, we have other things to talk about, and some of them not nearly so pleasant, unfortunately.
Yes, indeed.
Although some of what we'll talk about at least are perhaps encouraging signs. And one of them that, of course, we really should spend some time talking about because of your expertise involving the Korean Peninsula is the increasingly real possibility that there will be something that sort of resembles a summit between the United States and North Korea. And not all that long ago, the thought of that would have been just utterly preposterous. And it seems as though, in some ways, I'm reminded of the preposterous notion of the Berlin Wall coming down. And then, lo and behold, one day it did. I mean, and much more suddenly and I mean, sooner and more abruptly than people expected. And in some ways, I feel like these events involving North Korea are moving with similar rapidity, not that necessarily it will end as happily as the Berlin Wall story did. But are you surprised that these events seem to be moving as quickly as they are?
Or? Yes, but I'm often surprised. We do live in a world in which pervasive communication both creates a lot of problems, in my view, but also provides opportunities for breakthroughs, and life generally is becoming more informal. which means I believe that war is more likely, but not just in Korea, but and especially not in Korea, but also opportunities for positive change. I still get bollocksed up by international time zones, especially when the international dateline is involved. But on Friday, tomorrow, which is today, on the Korean Peninsula, the South Korean president and the leader of North Korea will be meeting in a truly historic summit. Only the third meeting in the last two since the war between the leaders of the two Koreas, and President Moon is I think unusually well qualified. It turns out that his predecessor is her fate is unfolded in a rather tragic manner, including bribery convictions in prison. And President Moon, I think, given his unusual background, is certainly well positioned to deal with Kim in the North.
Can you be more specific about what skills he brings or what gifts he brings to this that makes him so well equipped for this moment?
Yes, he's a human rights lawyer and demonstrated some courage during the very long and rather brutal dictatorship of President Park Chung-hee, who was assassinated by the head of his own CIA, his own intelligence agency, in 1979 after a dictatorship that went on for over a decade and a half. He was persecuted, prosecuted, and imprisoned by that particularly ugly military regime. He's also a veteran of the Korean Army. My first contact with Korea was in the U.S. Army, where I met some South Koreans, among other things. And it's an extraordinarily able and effective military. He was in their special forces, which is very effective indeed. And the military has been a positive factor in terms of economic development and also maintaining what I believe is the particularly important and particularly close alliance with the U.S. So it's an unusual combination.
Yeah.
It would be in our military.
Absolutely. So what is your understanding of what the highest hopes are for this summit between North and South Korea?
Well, the highest hopes expressed in the media and too many of our public spokespeople is the sky's the limit, and this is a whole new day and a whole new dawn, and American politicians, especially in recent years, I think have been much too inclined toward that vice of over-optimism. I think that if we can continue to put an effective freeze on nuclear weapons development in North Korea, that's all to the good. I mentioned human rights. There are tremendous long-term humanitarian needs in North Korea, which the collapse of that regime has been predicted now literally for decades, especially early in the new century. From the year 2000 and on, after a famine that was just, by all reliable accounts, truly horrible. There were a lot of fears of collapse of the North Korean regime. I was in South Korea in 2003. I've been very blessed to go to Korea on positive business reasons since 1985. And early in the century especially, South Korean diplomats and others were really worried about an imminent collapse of the North. And there was almost neurotic concern and focus on the challenge that Germany had when, as you indicated, the GDR, the German Democratic Republic, the Eastern Communist regime, suddenly, literally collapsed. How are we going to absorb this? That was just about almost 20 years ago. The regime is still holding, but the people are in desperate need.
Right.
And unrest, there are signs, clear signs, including public demonstrations and including one incident where North Korean troops fired on their own people. Even in the closed, crazy regime of North Korea, people are becoming more and more restive, as they should be. And we're well-positioned, and international organizations are well-positioned to use this summit and the likely summit between President Trump and Leader Kim in May or June to open the door for desperately needed aid and assistance.
That explains what's in it for North Korea. What do you see as the most significant benefit for South Korea, aside from the not inconsiderable matter of perhaps a reduction or freeze at least of North Korea's nuclear capability? Is that the main reason for South Korea to be entering into these talks?
No, not at all. The most important reason is a longing for national unity, especially among older Koreans, understandably. But Korea has a long history of great unity, unlike Germany, unlike Vietnam, by the way. It's not a nation that historically has been divided.
And that division is quite recent in its history.
Yes, from the end of World War II, Korea, which had been occupied by Japan. They have had a history of occupation. They've had to deal with the Chinese, the Russians. Historically, it's kind of a crossroads of imperialism and expansion by much larger powers. One reason they're such great warriors. From the beginning, I've been impressed by the tremendous warrior spirit of the Koreans. They're very effective in war, quite frightening, but one shouldn't have illusions about war. They were extremely effective in South Vietnam. They maintained 50,000 troops there during our long, terrible war, if I may say, in that country, mostly in the central coastal regions of South Vietnam, remarkably free of difficulty with the enemy. The other side went to great lengths, clearly, to avoid dealing with the South Koreans.
Hmm. So what about the prospects of talks between North Korea and the United States, and perhaps even a meeting between their leader and ours? Are you eager for that to occur? Some people are a little unhappy about it.
Not particularly. I'm pretty much a traditionalist, and ever more so as I get older. I think a summit should be, as Nixon and Kissinger demonstrated most dramatically, a summit should be the culmination after all the hard work has been done. Winston Lord, Kissinger's right-hand man, went to China again and dealt with Chou Enlai, who was running the show in those days in the early 70s, and Mao Zedong and others, a tremendous amount of groundwork for the door opening diplomatically, which has paid benefits we enjoy more of all the time. Mm. That's all to the good that we open the door to China. And the great ceremonial visit by President Nixon and Henry Kissinger in 1972 was not only extremely helpful, as were the strategic arms treaties with the Soviets, the two SALT treaties, in Nixon's smashing reelection before he suddenly went down. You were alluding to the suddenness with which things can change and develop nowadays. Well, that's always true in politics.
Yeah.
But a tremendous amount of groundwork has been done. If you don't do it that way, it's a recipe for disaster. President Kennedy is impulsive. I think it's appropriate to say his impulsive decision to meet with Khrushchev in Vienna in the spring of 61 in the wake of the Bay of Pigs disaster, not just with 2020 hindsight, just a terrible mistake by the U.S. government and the president. That shows just how bad things can be. It reinforced a very negative impression that the Soviets and Soviet intelligence had of Senator and then President Kennedy, and I believe led directly to the missile crisis of 62.
Interesting.
That's not going to happen now. But especially with a president who's, how do you put it politely, as unpredictable as our current president. I think as long as it's ceremonial, that's fine. It may not happen.
Well, of course, that's also a possibility. But it sounds like your main concern is that this is not likely to be substantive in the sense of the best kind of summit, which is a culminating event, of hard work behind the scenes.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you sum up what I was trying to say very well. South Korea and North Korea are the powers. I mean, it's their country. I don't think we should. I think we've been far too involved in the current administration. Hmm. And Nixon and also Kennedy, who had great strengths, let me emphasize, in my opinion, both Nixon and Kennedy were very conscious of both combat veterans of World War II, by the way, were very conscious of the contingency of events.
Hmm. While we're talking about that part of the world, I wanted to briefly ask you about your sense of the state of affairs in the nation of China right now. I recently interviewed the author of a book called China's Great Wall of Debt. And it is the contention of this author, whose name now escapes me, that that China has expanded far too rapidly, and there are all kinds of idle factories and empty apartment buildings and this and that in various parts of China that speak to maybe growth that was, in a sense, unchecked and a little bit out of control, and that that could be signs that in fact the overall economy of China is not sort of the unstoppable juggernaut that we often sort of imagine it to be. I'm just wondering what that sounds like to you, if that squares with anything that you know about the current state of affairs in China.
Yes, I'm gonna I'll seek out the in your very effective archive online. I will seek that out and listen to it. It sounds right to me. It sounds accurate. And a lot of what's going on in terms of the rapid evolution and big problems in China seems like deja vu all over again, as that great statesman Yogi Berra would say. The nation of Japan, well into the 1990s, from the 70s into the 90s, was the great enemy. They were taking over America. There was some. There was a very ugly eruption of old-fashioned wartime hatred, as well as racism against Japan, expressed especially by some auto workers in this country. Japan seemed to be taking over everything, and they were buying golf courses and the Empire State Building, and Disneyland was going to go down, and that was a long time ago. I show my students regularly the I have a VHS tape of the first Kennedy-Nixon debate. I believe they're all readily available online. Two very gifted, remarkably young politicians, the first presidential debates ever, to say nothing of televised. They both speak at length. They're both, the students regularly comment on that. They're, you know, they seem like grown-up men, which they were. They speak at length. They don't blow kisses at each other. They don't beat their breasts, and not mentioning any names,
right,
and bellow rhetorically. They were focused on the Soviet Union, and indeed, they will bury us if, as Jack Kennedy kept emphasizing, we don't change and become much more active and much more aggressive in the world. The USA is still here. These big powers have either faded or disappeared. Why is that? I ask students. I ask myself.
Why are we still here?
Yeah, and doing fine. We're actually doing fine for all our social chaos and, you know, kind of goofy politics, past and present, really. Why are we still here? I've got an hour-long answer for that. So. But it's important to keep that in mind, especially our listeners. People worry so much. I think people worry more now at some level than they did when I was growing up, when I was worried, like all teenagers. But why are we so anxious in this great country?
Right.
Yeah.
I think you're speaking to a very important question for
sure. Thank you. Yeah, and there's no short answer, and there's no glib media answer.
Right. But sometimes it would be good to actually have a sustained conversation about exactly that. I would welcome that.
And with our colleagues. You do a great job of drawing on a wider pool, I believe, over time, of Carthage colleagues. And it's an opportunity for us to work together to expand that pool.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, Director of the A.W. Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War, and of course, Professor Sear joins us on a regular basis to offer his thoughts on a plethora of issues both here and around the world. You wrote recently a column that opened with a reference to Shakespeare. That garnered my attention for sure. It was actually a means to speak about Brexit and what you characterize as Britain's...
That's the country he was from.
Right.
In case somebody doesn't know.
Right. I would hope most of our listeners know that. I'm pretty sure they do. But you were using that as a point of departure to talk about what is shaping up to be kind of a messy exit for Great Britain from the European Union. Explain to our listeners what is getting so messy about this. I mean, not that it was ever going to be easy, but now it sort of looks like it's going to be even less easy than maybe someone might have hoped.
Yes, I believe April 26th is the confirmed date of Shakespeare's baptism. We don't know when he was born, but I did a little research before I quoted Macbeth on business people and commerce and greed. And so the assumption is he was born somewhere around April 23. But it was a good, you know, the lessons are endless, including concerning war and the most intimate human relations and the most important human activities. It is a bridge to Brexit. The bureaucrats in the European Union see it that way because a high-ranking European official, it may have been the president of the commission, I can't remember, quite recently when the latest flap and unpleasantness about this British withdrawal said, well, the nation that gave us Shakespeare and Churchill is a great nation and we must keep that in mind. I think I'm quoting accurately.
Yeah.
To actually answer your question, Britain has always been ambiguous about the continent, and they pretty much ran the world for a couple of hundred years, from the 1700s into the 1900s. That's no exaggeration. And they did it, among other things, by trying to manipulate skillfully events in Europe on the continent, but institutionally staying aloof. Mind you, since 1949, they've been a strong supporter of NATO, and that will continue, and I think NATO will grow in importance. But they are strenuously trying to withdraw from the European Union. The previous Prime Minister, David Cameron, outsmarted himself after ruthlessly undercutting his coalition partners, the Liberal Democrats, and his party winning a bare majority on their own in a general election in 2015. He decided to have a referendum, which turned out to be a move too far because, to everyone's surprise, including the pollsters, a bare majority of people in Britain who voted to leave the Union. That really did surprise everyone. Cameron immediately resigned, which is how their tough system works. And Theresa May is part of a relatively younger generation of Tory politicians elected in 1997 who have moved the party from support of entering the Union, the earlier European Economic Community, something that Harold Macmillan very courageously decided to do in the early 60s. And that was continuous in the Conservative Party. The party has really changed positions. The Liberal Democrats, the old Liberal Party, they're the only ones who've been consistently for the European Union. But the Prime Minister, who's got her own serious problems and may not last much longer, she has been stridently, actively, actually rather abrasively committed to getting out of the European Union. It's a newer it's a newer generation that has changed the party. And it's been a very kind of rough Margaret Thatcher approach to politics, in contrast to the David Camerons and especially Harold Macmillans of the world. The old aristocracy has faded, and these people are really quite hostile to Europe, and that's a powerful strain in Britain. Historically, we don't want to be part of those very different people.
Yeah.
By contrast, they love the States. When you're there, it's like the States are right next door. In Europe.
You mean the United States?
Yes, the U.S. Sorry.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. The way they refer to us, the States.
Right.
Yeah.
Like we're just
from the States.
That neighbor across the pond,
yeah.
And yet right across that narrow channel is that they might as well be on another planet.
There was a famous London Times headline from early in the 20th century, fog across channel, fog hits channel, referring to the English Channel. Continent cut off.
That's good. Well, it's certainly going to be interesting to see what the ramifications are more widely in terms of what this exit from Brexit is really going to mean, and in particular, what is it going to mean for kind of the state of affairs with the European Union itself. what Britain's relationship will continue to be. You mentioned that the Prime Minister is in some trouble, and you're thinking it's possible at least she's not going to be Prime Minister much longer. Is that what you were implying?
Yeah, she called a snap general election. She outsmarted herself as well, which we academics can point out from the safe haven of the sheltered groves. She called an election and lost the majority, the narrow majority that the Conservatives had in the House of Commons. And ironically, they've been able to govern only with the support of a very right-wing Ulster, Northern Ireland party. So her headaches are endless. And in their cabinet system, it really is a rather collective system, unlike ours, she's had great difficulty maintaining support in the polls, but also among her colleagues. And there are more than a few people, as usual, who would like very much to put the kind of knife in her back that will take her down, and someone else will come in. Brexit is, we should explain, is the shorthand terms for Britain exiting the EU. And it's a shorthand reference to we want to leave that organization.
Right. Well, that will be certainly events that we will want to follow very, very closely.
Oh, yeah, we are. It's getting a lot of play along with the new baby, royal baby. It's getting a lot of who will be named soon.
Right.
Yes, America seems breathless.
Yes, absolutely. Let's talk for a moment, if we could. I don't know how much you were able to see of it, but French President Macron has, of course, been visiting the United States and not only met face-to-face with President Trump, but then spoke to both houses of Congress in quite an impassioned speech in which, among other things, he was fairly direct in terms of expressing concerns about certainly some of the decisions that that the current president and his administration have made, particularly when it regards to things like climate change and welfare of the environment and so on. And I think some people were maybe just a touch taken aback at a foreign leader standing in the U.S. Capitol and speaking so forthrightly and criticizing our current president. Does that surprise you, or is that the kind of thing that that is bound to happen?
He was more blunt than I would have anticipated. I think from my own point of view, given the character of our current leadership, I think it was all to the good. He's an amazing person. National leaders often are, good, bad, or both. But he's, I think, still only around 40. He was a high flyer in the very demanding and extremely prestigious French civil service. He has elite educational credentials. He made a lot of money very quickly in investment banking, and now he's charged into politics and done very well in a short period of time. So I'm very impressed and very much admire him. The French were our close allies during the American Revolution, I beg your pardon, and made a crucial difference. For many years, especially in the 60s, there was intense conflict between a very nationalist France led by General Charles de Gaulle, a truly great, larger-than-life historic person who felt his highest priority had to be restoring France's self-respect. They developed their own independent nuclear weapons program, much to the annoyance of Washington. And it was really sustained conflict during the 60s. He left in 68, but throughout that decade, he and Kennedy especially had an intense conflict. I think the stakes were much higher then. I think those two personalities were a good deal more impressive than national leaders today, again, you know, sitting here in the sheltered groves. But that was really a tough time in alliance relations. The fact that France is back to being a close ally of the U.S. is extremely important and extremely positive, and the fact that we're so close and so free that he can appear before the Congress and criticize us. One of the many strengths of our country is we have the First Amendment, which I believe is more important all the time, at least as important as it was during the McCarthy era.
It's increasingly important.
Yeah, given trends in the U.S., including ugly trends in academia, I might say, fortunately, not currently at our college, as far as I can tell. But the Europeans don't. And what's so popular in certain quarters in our country, especially, I'm sorry to say, emerging universities, speech codes, limiting speech. Let's be inclusive by prohibiting certain things being said or things being done in symbolic terms. The Europeans like that kind of thing, especially the Germans and the Austrians and the East Europeans. I think it's very important more than ever for us to emphasize free speech, meaning really free speech, not just speech that I like or speech that satisfies my psychological needs, but really free speech, buddy.
Incidentally, I hadn't thought to ask you about this, but it occurs to me that one of the most important developments since your last visit to the morning show was the testimony on Capitol Hill of Mark Zuckerberg.
Ah, yes.
The head of Facebook. And, of course, I'm sure we don't really have to even explain why he was speaking to Congress and the enormous firestorm of criticism that has swirled around Facebook and the elevated concerns on all quarters about, you know, in a sense, sort of the state of affairs of the Internet and particularly social media and the way in which it is being manipulated and is subject to misappropriation and so on. And I think a lot of people found Mr. Zuckerberg's testimony enlightening, and it was quite a spectacle in a sense, and it's raising all kinds of interesting questions. And what you were just saying now about the First Amendment and freedom of speech and so on, that's very much tied up in some of the thorny issues that get raised when we are talking, for instance, about social media, whether it should be regulated and so on. I wonder what thoughts it has stirred up in your inquisitive mind, his testimony and other discussion about some of these questions.
I think your comments would probably be more insightful and interesting than mine. I don't think it's that important. I thought he was remarkably awkward. He was uninformed. About the wider policy context and impact on the public of his corporation. He's obviously a very brilliant businessman, like the president of France at a very young age. He's been extraordinarily successful, which should be inspiring. That's the nature of our system more than any other in the world. I thought he was patronizing and condescending in talking to people in Congress. It's interesting, at least two of our colleagues on the faculty at the college have told me that, boy, the congressman really seemed dumb. You know, they didn't know the technical aspects, obviously, of how these massive information and misinformation systems work. I had the reverse impression. Always keep in mind that in public hearings, especially where there's a lot of attention, the politicians are not asking questions to get substantive answers. They are making statements to impress their constituents. They've gotten elected to office at the federal level in an extremely competitive system. These people aren't dumb. If they seem dumb to you, that means that we academics are rather removed from the system. I think the resentment and hostility expressed toward that corporation reflects a lot of public sentiments in this country. Facebook's not going to go down. They're still going to make money. They may even get stronger in the future, given the public demand for this kind of technical behavior, technical service. That's self-evident. John D. Rockefeller had the capacity to shut down the United States of America. He had a monopoly, 90% plus, of kerosene as well as petroleum in the 1800s. The first big, important antitrust case was against Standard Oil, I think, of New Jersey. It was a national corporation, Standard Oil of New Jersey, that was the main center. He could shut down the U.S. Navy and very possibly the Army, certainly a large part of the American economy. It wasn't just these fuel products, but they had distribution systems. Standard Oil owned railroads. They owned oil wells. They owned storage facilities. They owned big dumps and depots. He could strangle until he was arrested, presumably. He could strangle the American economy. What's Facebook? Facebook is, from my grumpy old point of view, a source of narcissism. You can look in the mirror. you don't have to spend your time literally looking in the mirror when you can look on your... Now, mind you, it is important. Our Enactus Team 1 student service organization that our center supports as a priority, they won at the regional competition recently. Chelsea Nemeth and her fellow students did a superb job, as usual. And the news went out through her Facebook page while I was still wondering when we were going to get something on the college news site, The Bridge. So it's important for information. But whatever happens in Facebook is not going to shut down the United States of America or threaten to. Rockefeller was also invariably polite. He was low-key. He was respectful. He did not patronize, especially in talking to powerful politicians. I think those old-time capitalists overall did a lot better than the new time, especially high-tech entrepreneurs in our country. So that's what I think. But what do you think? You're dealing with the media. I mean, you're immersed in the media in a way that I'm not. My job involves writing some columns.
Sure.
It works for the college.
Right. No, I think you're. I think most people would agree that Mark Zuckerberg has always had a problem with being condescending, and relating to regular people, and in some respects, even those United States congressmen who were posing questions to him are regular people in the sense of not being.
That's it, exactly.
Yeah,
and that's how you get elected
right.
in this country.
Yeah, and no one should expect them to be deeply immersed in the world in which he is deeply immersed and obviously very easily conversant. That being said, I do have to admit I would not say that they came off as dumb, but I would have hoped that some of them would have had a little more a little stronger sense of sort of the context in which these questions were being asked.
Uh-huh.
I mean, when people are posing questions like, so what's the difference between Facebook and Twitter? If you don't know that, if something as basic as that, you know, it seems to me you're not in a position to be, hurling criticism at Mark Zuckerberg. You should know a little bit more about what you're talking about before, sweeping criticisms. But that being said, I also think, just to be a little sympathetic to him, I think he was in a tough spot because I think he probably felt like he needed to try to explain some of these things in addition to then sort of answering the question and defending his company and so on. I mean, I didn't envy his position. I think he was in a tough place, and it was almost inevitable that the kind of unpleasant facets of his personality were almost inevitably going to be revealed in a tricky situation like that.
But how important do you think social media is collectively? Clearly not just President Trump and President Obama are two, from my point of view, most celebrity presidents, people who were elected very heavily based on the media rather than actual policy accomplishments. To what extent is social media really important in our country?
I think it's...
And why?
Well, it seems to be tremendously important and increasingly important, particularly in the sense that many people, polls show, primarily get their information from social media. I mean, that many, many people are not reaching for the New York Times. They're clicking on it on Facebook and certain things that have been selected for them. And I think part of the danger of something like Facebook is that because Facebook is in the business of feeding you things that you want to read and that align with what you already think, that that's the big difference between actually picking up the New York Times and surveying all of the things that are there. Facebook is feeding you these items from the New York Times that it believes align with your preconceptions, and that's I think that it is having an effect of sort of fortifying our own polarization for that reason. Mm-hmm. To say nothing of the other things that circulate on Facebook that may or may not be based in fact, but the fact that lots and lots of people, I mean, I'm on it every day. I wouldn't say it's my primary. It's not my primary means of getting information, but for many, many people, it is.
Yeah.
And you end up, in a sense, taking in only slanted information with which you already agree. And to me, that's a recipe for trouble for us as a nation socially.
It increases private corporate power, too, doesn't it? Big Brother really is out there watching you, collecting information about you, and marketing to you. I get unnerved when I get these pop-up ads about a book or Amazon especially, clothing articles, other things that may appeal to you. And it's almost eerie what they know about you. That is insidious. It's a kind of power that John D. Rockefeller might have fantasized about but could never acquire.
Right.
And we're kind of losing our privacy. The government is bad enough, but corporations, which get you where you live, it's one reason I was praising the First Amendment, the whole Bill of Rights, including our right to privacy and protection from unreasonable search and seizure. Corporations can really get into your life if they want to. And I emphasize this to students because it's not just students but Washington officials. What people will put in email and what young people will put up on the web can hurt you later on professionally.
Right.
And I've said this in all seriousness to students, always with a prologue. I'm not trying to pry into your personal affairs, but what you sent me is not really what you... You know, or this link, it's not really, think about what it might do in terms of a future job.
Right.
And the degree to which corporations can manipulate information I find disturbing, and the financial power that they hold. Unlike Rockefeller, who was an accountant and sat around with accountants in expensive suits and spent much of the day analyzing things, they had to go out and make deals. But Zuckerberg is a tech finance genius. My guess is the interpersonal skills that earlier business people had to have are not so important today with the rise of finance and tech.
What I will say about
that combined with their power, I find disturbing.
Right. I will say that part of what I found compelling about his testimony was the extent to which he was willing to express regret for the fact that he thought Facebook had not been nearly mindful enough of some of the potential harm that some of these practices could cause. I thought he was pretty forthright about that, particularly in comparison to past public statements in which he tended to minimize those kind of things. I thought he owned that to a degree that surprised me anyway. But
Well, you are a fair man. That's good for you.
Well, I try. Well, in the meantime, we've certainly dug into plenty of important issues. When you come next, I want to be sure that we spend some time to talk about the general state of the United States economy. And we also have plenty more to talk about in terms of the administration of President Trump. And let's see.
No doubt.
Yes. Let's see where he is in a month. But
who knows?
But the clock says we need to leave it there. So Professor Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy at Carthage and Director of the A.W. Clausen Center, thank you so much for yet another illuminating hour. It's always a pleasure to speak with you on the morning show.
Well, thank you, Professor Berg. I'm glad that's still true. You'll tell me when it's not.
Absolutely. But for now, we're in good shape. So thank you again for being here. Tomorrow on the morning show, out of the archives, a favorite interview of mine with the author of a book about the early days of radio, the very, very earliest days of radio in the early 20th century, a technological breakthrough that now we tend to utterly take for granted. But it really reshaped this country and how we had a sense of connection with one another. The book is called Hello, Everybody, and we'll rerun that interview tomorrow. Support for The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. You can build a career as a licensed professional counselor and mental health and wellness advocate with the new Master's in Mental Health and Counseling from Parkside. You're invited to visit uwp.edu. And we want to remind you once again of Wisconsin Public Radio's Spring Membership Drive. If you would like to be a part of that and express your appreciation for Wisconsin Public Radio and WGTD, we would encourage you to go to the website www.wpr.org, or you can call them toll-free at 888-202-2552. and please mention that you are a listener to WGTD. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News.